Business News Special Report. A presidential news conference from CBS News headquarters in New York. Here is Dan Rather.
Good evening. President Reagan will enter the White House East Room shortly for a news conference. It'll be his second formal news conference of 1986. Mr. Reagan may want to talk about the release today of Soviet dissident Anatoly Sharansky. He may also face questions on a global hot topic, the U.S. position on the completed but not yet decided and allegedly riddled by fraud presidential election in the Philippines, the U.S. role in ending the widely feared and disliked Duvalier dynasty in Haiti, and other questions. We now go to the East Room of the White House.
Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States.
Well, good evening. Please sit down. I have a brief statement here. We have, as you know, set our budget to the Congress. And it's a fair and responsible budget, and clearly does the job of putting America on course to a balanced budget through steadily declining deficits, as mandated by the new Graham-Rudman-Hollings law. Now, last Friday, a three-judge panel of the Federal District Court issued a ruling against a portion of Graham-Rudman-Hollings. We await a final Supreme Court decision, but nothing the court says should or will remove our obligation to bring overspending under control. Congress shares that obligation. It must meet its responsibility to reduce deficit spending and pass a budget resolution by April 15th. For our part, we have met the targets for lower deficits, but not by cutting Social Security or essential support for low-income persons, and not by gutting defense or raising taxes on the American people. We mean to cut unessential spending out of the federal budget, and we mean to leave family budgets alone. All told, our budget meets the deficit targets in part by cutting about 5% from domestic programs. That's 5 cents on the dollar, and that's what we're asking Congress to cut. If Congress can't do that much, well, then they should at least give me a line item veto, because I'll make the cuts and get the job done. Let's be frank. Those who say that our budget is DOA, dead on arrival, are really saying, brace yourself for a tax increase. I think taxpayers want Congress to get its own house in order. I do too. So rest assured that any tax increase sent to me will be VOA, veto on arrival. Now,
President, the observers you sent to the Philippines have just returned with reports that they witnessed fraud and violence. Doesn't this undermine the credibility of the election and strengthen the hand of the communist insurgents in the island?
Well, I am not going to comment on this process, just as they are not going to render an official report until the counting has finally been finished. I don't think it would be proper to do so. Yes, they told me in just an interim few remarks and made it plain that they are not going to issue the official report yet, but they told me that there was the appearance of fraud, and yet at the same time said that they didn't have any hard evidence beyond that general appearance. So we're going to wait, we're neutral, and we then hope to have the same relationship with the people of the Philippines that we've had for all these historic years.
Finally, follow up, sir. Did what they tell you give you concern about the credibility there and what the impact will be for U.S. interests in the Philippines?
Well, I think that we're concerned about the violence that was evident there and the possibility of fraud, although it could have been that all of that was occurring on both sides, but at the same time, we're encouraged with the fact that is evidence that there is a two-party system in the Philippines and a pluralism that I think would benefit their people. And we're glad to see that particular thing happen, and we'll wait until we hear the outcome.
Mr. President, in the 60s, you opposed all civil rights legislation, but more recently you said that you were a part of the Martin Luther King Revolution. Since if that is the case, why is your administration so bent on wiping out the flexible hiring goals for blacks, minorities, and women? And I'd like to follow up.
Helen, we're not wanting to do that, but we have seen, in administering these programs, we've seen that the affirmative action program was becoming a quota system. Now, I've lived long enough to have seen quotas when they were employed long before there was a civil rights movement, when they were employed in my youth to definitely discriminate and use the quota as a means of discrimination. And therefore, we feel that yes, we want affirmative action to continue. We want what I think Martin Luther King asked for. We want a colorblind society. We want, the ideal will be when we have achieved a moment when no one, or when nothing is done to or for anyone because of race differences or religion or ethnic origin. And it's done in, not because of those things, but in spite of them.
The affirmative action order specifically forbids quotas. And I'd really like to say to you, do you think if you had been born a black or a woman that you would be president today?
I didn't think I'd be president today when I was born, or for a great many years afterward. But, Helen, no, the thing, whatever the law may say, and I know what Hubert Humphrey said about it, and this is what we're talking about. We were talking about the practice. Not individually and personally, no, but we find down there at the bureaucracy level and out there actually in personnel offices and so forth. They choose the easy course, set down a system of numbers and say, well, we'll go by that. And this is what we're trying to correct. Now, wait a minute. If you'll let me please do something I haven't done before, but just recently a group of newcomers to your ranks came into the Oval Office, and I met them, and I thought that since they are newcomers, at least just as a representative here to start with, let me call on a couple of those. I don't even know where you're sitting. Maybe you didn't have your hands up or not, but just two of them, and then we'll go on with the regular hands up. Dave Beckwith of Time.
Thank you, Mr. President. Recently, two of your top economic officials, OMB Director Miller and CEA Director Beryl Sprinkle, have suggested that the Federal Reserve should be tightening a little more, worrying about inflation in conducting the nation's monetary supply. Do you agree with them that the Fed has been too loose lately?
Well, I have to admit that, you know, it isn't an easy, the tools aren't that sharp that you can maintain the money supply exactly where you want it all the time. And it is true that recently it got above their own bracket, their own line of where they wanted to keep the increase. And sure enough, you saw a couple of percentage points on the low side of the zero of the period, added to what has been well under 4% inflation rate. So I think this is what they were referring to, that we've got to keep our eye on that and keep it there as much as we can. Now the other one was Walter Robinson, Boston Globe.
Mr. President, your State of the Union message last week, you said that we need welfare reform and that the true test of a welfare system is one in which people get off of welfare. And the day after you said that, the governor of Massachusetts was in town to talk about a program in his state which has taken 23,000 people, trained them in jobs, and taken them off welfare. That program and others like it in other states have been made possible by a federal program, work incentives. Now, the next day, on Wednesday, your budget recommended abolishing this program, and I'd like to ask you why that is.
Well, I don't think that program was really the manner or the way by which the states were doing that. You see, what those states are doing and what Governor Dukakis is doing in his state is what we did in California as part of our welfare reforms way back when I was governor there. And when I got here, I had our people start informing the states of this. We were allowed an experiment at that time. We could only do it in 35 counties. And the department then in Washington refused to allow us to do it in San Francisco and Los Angeles counties. But what we did was submit a questionnaire to the 35 counties, to the communities in the counties, and we said, would they send us a list of the things that they would be doing if they had the manpower and the money? Useful things. And we got quite a list, and few, if any, boondoggles. We crossed them out when there were some. And then we said, okay, you've got the manpower and the money. We are going to order able-bodied welfare recipients to report for these useful jobs. No more money to be spent. It was the same money. They're doing it in return for their welfare grants. And then at the same time, well, we only had them work 20 hours a week, so we wouldn't be violating any minimum wage requirements. We said the other 20 must be spent either in job training or job hunting. And we assigned job agents to these people. Had each one of them had a list of names to watch these people, and they were doing these community chores. And we funneled through that program and into private enterprise jobs, not 23,000, 76,000 people. And this was during the recession of 73 and 74. And when we got here to Washington, we said it worked so well there, and let's see if there aren't going to be other states that would be interested in it. But it's just a plain welfare grant that makes this possible for others to do.
I'll just follow up. This program, which is administered by the Labor Department, provides job training funds. And the Massachusetts program has found that for every dollar that's spent, the government gets $2 back in welfare savings. And it seems to have been a success. The Labor Department says it has been. And yet you've recommended to cancel. And it seems to fly in the face of your stated purpose in your State of the Union message.
Well, but we are keeping the program, the partnership program, in which we, in partnership with local governments and the private sector, train for jobs that are going begging in that particular area. There's not much point in going into an area and training people for jobs that aren't available. But you only have to look at the Sunday papers, and I've mentioned it before, the Help Wanted ads, to find out that there are employers that are having trouble finding employees. And so we're training for that specific thing, and it has the highest job placement record of any of the employment programs the government has ever tried. Leslie?
I have so many questions to ask you, sir. I can't decide which one. But I will ask you, if I can, about your statement on taxes. Your budget calls for cuts in domestic programs. You call them non-essential, but a lot of people don't agree with you. You're calling for cuts in education, in school lunches, other nutrition programs. You're calling for cuts in student aid. The question is, why won't you accept something like an oil import tax or an oil import fee that would not disturb your basic tax cut for the individual in order to save some of these programs that so many Americans do consider essential?
Well, I don't think that we're cutting the essential parts. No one looks far enough to see that the small amount of the cut is in what could be called the area of fat. That's an administration. No level of government has the high-cost administration than the federal government. At every echelon of government where they perform a program for the people, the percentage of the dollar that goes to administer that program is less at the community level, a little higher at the county level, a little higher at the state level, and tremendously higher at the federal level. Now, if we can eliminate some fat, we can handle it. But also, you don't bat 1,000% in making sure that everyone is deserving. For example, in programs such as the aid to college students, we find students that are getting this aid, and their families are in an income tax bracket, an income bracket, that really, there's no reason or excuse for them to be getting federal help.
People refute you. Black college enrollment is way down. A lot of middle-class families with many children find it much harder to send their children to college. And why won't you accept that oil import fee to offset that?
Because it's historic that when you go above a certain percentage in taking revenue from the private sector, government taking revenue from the private sector, you find that you slow the economy. And this is why the latest evidence of this is that our tax program, once instituted, I think is the principal reason for the 38 straight months of economic recovery that we have had. Sam?
Mr. President, 2 weeks ago, your chief of staff, Donald Regan, said that if Ferdinand Marcos was reelected and certified as such, we would have to do business with him even if he were reelected through fraud. Is that your policy?
What we have to say is that the determination of the government in the Philippines is going to be the business of the Philippine people, not the United States. And we are going to try and continue, as I said before, the relationship, regardless of what government is instituted there by the choice of the people. And that's all I can answer.
If I may, sir, it is argued that there's a communist insurgency there, that the best way to play into the hands of the communists is to back someone, a dictator, who has been reelected by fraud, that the best way, it is argued, to oppose the communist insurgency is to back the forces of democracy. What about that?
Well, we're backing the forces of democracy, and the people there are voting, and they're holding their own election, and the only party in the Philippines that boycotted the election was the Communist Party. So there's very great evidence that whatever takes place, you've got two parties, and the evidence that a sizable percentage of each party has voted for a different candidate of the two candidates. So there is a solid support for both candidates there. Now, as I said before, I'm not going to comment on any of these other things while this vote count is still going forward. No, Chris?
Mr. President, the Soviets today released dissident Anatoly Sharansky, but of course there are thousands of other Soviets who would like to leave that country that the Soviets won't let leave. Do you regard today's release as a propaganda move, or do you see any real change in the human rights situation in the Soviet Union?
Chris, I don't have any way to determine whether what their motives are in doing this. I only know that since the Geneva meeting, there have been not only this, but others released, more so than in a great many years. I'm encouraged by this because I did talk at great length about the matter of human rights with the General Secretary, and all we can do is hope that this is a beginning, a sign for what's going to continue to take place.
I may follow up, sir. Mr. Gorbachev says that he cannot release another leading dissident, Andrei Sakharov, because of his knowledge of Soviet nuclear secrets. Do you see any legitimacy to that argument?
Well, it's an argument they've used for a number of people. People who have, in their estimation, been close to some things that they feel are secrets for their own security, and that they have said that they cannot let people go that have access to those secrets. Now, I have no way of judging how valid that is, but as I say, they've made a start, and I hope it is just a start, and that they'll continue. Ralph?
Mr. President, did the United States play any role in President Duvalier's decision to leave Haiti? And a second question, if I may, Mr. President, do you intend to increase economic aid for the new government there?
Ralph, we are just faced now with what we can do. I can only tell you that we hope we can be of help as this interim government goes forward to try to institute democracy there in Haiti. Our participation in the Duvalier's leaving was that of providing an airplane to fly into France.
You didn't give him any strong advice from him, did you?
No. And he never He never asked us for any.
Mr. President, you spoke last week about one of the great fears of the American people as they grow older, that their lifetime of savings will be wiped out by catastrophic illness. And government and private studies suggest that the real risk of being wiped out by catastrophic illness lies not in the hospital and the doctor's bills, but in long-term chronic care, like nursing homes. Are you willing to open the Social Security system, the Medicare system, to pay for nursing home care for the chronically ill elderly?
I have asked, I can't answer your question here because I've asked simply for a study as to how we can meet the total catastrophic thing for the people who have need. And as I say, we had a program that we thought would have worked successfully in California, and we couldn't get any public interest in it, and it would have provided unlimited care and through a private insurance cover so that there wouldn't have been any governmental administrative overhead in the program.
Do you rule out the use of general tax revenue to support premiums to a plan to support nursing home care?
Well, the plan that we had in California, the individuals, the cost was so low that the individuals could meet the premium cost of that. Now, if there were some people that couldn't, why, I'm quite sure if we help in anything else, we would help in that too.
President, the United States, as you know, is beginning to resume the flight operations in the Mediterranean near Libya. Do you believe that, and it's also designed to reassert our right to patrol international waters, why then haven't we crossed that line that Gaddafi calls the death line?
Well, I don't know the nature of the operations that have been conducted. They conduct them in various parts of the Mediterranean. I don't know that they're all through yet. We have conducted operations there very early on in my administration, in which I was informed, because they thought I should be, that he had ordered that was their waters, which was akin to us claiming all of the waters from the tip of Florida over to the border of Mexico and Texas, and that some of the maneuvers would entail some planes and some ships in crossing that line, but not getting into what are actually their waters. And I gave the go-ahead on that, and I would again. I don't know if they didn't cross it in any way this time, it must have been because the maneuvers did not call for it.
Do you think, though, that resuming the operations at this time might be playing into Gaddafi's hand, that by helping him project the image that he wants to, that he's being picked on by the U.S.?
Well, it didn't add to his image the first time we did it. And as I say, it would be done not for any impression on him. It would be done because simply we believe that our squadrons were there. The Navy is going to have to conduct exercises and keep itself in fighting shape. And I'm going to call him not because you've got a red dress on, but just because you caught my eye.
And because it's Nancy's favorite designer. Mr. President, in view of the many corporate mergers going on, both friendly and unfriendly, and in view of the fact that in a few years we perhaps could wind up with only a handful of billion-dollar conglomerates, would the administration plan to propose or support any legislation to limit some of these mergers, which are getting a little bit out of hand?
Well, I can't comment on whether they're getting out of hand or not, but I do know that we have a body of law that offers us all the protection we need. In fact, I think as we've expanded into a world competition, some of that law has been overprotective. We have to recognize now that we're not just dealing with competition within our own borders, but competition with firms from outside the borders. And no, I don't believe that there's any threat or danger of monopoly control here in our land at all, and I don't think there will be.
Mr. Gorbachev may be trying to win some concessions on arms control in exchange for an agreement on this.
I don't think so. That kind of linkage wouldn't work.
Yes, you.
Easy way, and I want to fix it so they can't do this the easy way. President, are the two U.S. bases in the Philippines of paramount importance when you consider U.S. policy for the Philippines, or would you put the future of those bases at some risk if it meant standing up for democracy there?
One cannot minimize the importance of those bases, not only to us, but to the Western world, and certainly to the Philippines themselves. That, if you look at the basing now of the Blue Ocean Navy that Soviet has built, to be bigger than ours, and how they have placed themselves to be able to intercept the 16 choke points in the world. There are 16 passages in the world, sea passages, through which most of the supplies and the raw material and so forth reaches not only ourselves, but our allies in the Western world. And obviously, the plan in case of any kind of hostilities calls for intercepting and closing those 16 choke points. And we have to have bases that we can send forces to reopen those channels. And I don't know if any of it's more important than the bases on the Philippines.
Has the U.S. given any consideration to other places in the region we might have bases if the situation in the Philippines seemed to become untenable?
I have to tell you that as good military will always do, and not just here, but in any of this, I am confident that our Navy has sought for and is looking for contingency plans for anything that might happen anyplace to us.
Thank you.
Thank you, Helen.
Good evening. Welcome to the 1986 Awards Convocation. I'm honored to present to you members of the Board of Trustees who are on the platform. I request that you hold your applause until all have been introduced. The Honorable Malcolm Day, Chairperson of the Board, the Honorable Carol Lett, the Honorable Dean Crickin, the Honorable Barbara Sawyer, the Honorable Patrick Wilson. We appreciate you being here very much. Also on the platform, interpreting for handicappers with hearing characteristics is Miss Marlene Ehrenberger of Better Hearing and Speech. Since John A. D. DiBiagio became president of Michigan State University on July 1, 1985, the citizens of Michigan have seen firsthand his off-stated philosophy that, quote, people should know their land-grant university is accessible to them, and that its president should always be right there to prove it, unquote. In the short time he has served as president of Michigan State, John DiBiagio has become a leading advocate throughout the state for higher education and for its land-grant university. He and his wife, Carolyn, have always called Michigan home. When Dr. DiBiagio was inaugurated as the 17th president of Michigan State University last September, Governor James Blanchard said, it would be difficult, if not impossible, to find a more articulate and eloquent spokesperson for this university. Clearly, this assessment was and is correct. In his talk with civic leaders, legislators, prospective students, faculty, parents, economic development groups, and many, many others, Dr. DiBiagio has repeated this premise. Michigan State University has the responsibility to not only carry the banner as the nation's pioneering high-end university, Michigan State must view itself as the premier high-end university. a leading national advocate for public and higher education. Dr. DiBiagio will serve in 1986-87 as chairperson of the National Association of State Universities and Land-Grant Colleges. The organization, which he has served as a member of its executive committee, head of its committee on governmental relations, and member of the select ad hoc committee on the future of state universities. It is my distinct honor tonight to present the person I hope is giving the first of many state of the university addresses to this Michigan State University community, the 17th president of Michigan State University, Dr. John A. DiBiagio. Well, just a few months ago, I stood on this same stage as a candidate for installation as the 17th president of Michigan State University. I was pretty certain at that time that I already had the job, since we had moved into Cole's house, and I'd been provided a key to an office on the fourth floor of the administration building. But I must tell you that on that inauguration day, a day when it was evident to me that on a sunny autumn day or afternoon, there really is no better place in the world to be than on this particular campus, I did a great deal of thinking. On the stage, helping me to ponder some of my ideas was Governor Jim Blanchard, here on what was a historic mission. This was the first time a graduate could return as governor of the state to participate in the installation of a new president of this university. The presence of the Board of Trustees also helped me to collect my thoughts that day. Men and women, Republican and Democrat, black and white, elected and appointed, this board certainly said something very good about this university. I sat on the stage that day and listened to Stan Eikenberry, president of the University of Illinois, talk with deep affection about Michigan State. And I thought, that's how our alumni always feel about their university. Across the stage, members of the Presidential Search Committee smiled, probably in relief that their ordeal was finally over, but nevertheless conveying an air of common accomplishment. I stood that day with my wife, Carolyn, beside me and thought about coming home. And many of you in the audience tonight were in the audience that afternoon as well. I must tell you that I saw you, and I felt your presence and your support. And I imagined that no other president anywhere was ever welcomed so graciously and so sincerely. Feeling the presence and support of others and committing oneself to returning the favor, that was a silent commitment that I made to all of you that afternoon. That's the commitment I make tonight as I speak for the land-grant university of this great state of Michigan. In Michigan, the state of this university and the state of the state are clearly interwoven. That interdependency has made the Michigan State University story a revolutionary one. Over the years, we have seen a daring experiment proven and replicated throughout the world. And the home of that experiment, the land-grant experiment, is a campus that we are privileged to walk. We are, and we always have been, the University for Michigan. If we claim we are special and unique in this state, it is because we were created and mandated to be special and unique. Our claim is based on our heritage, not on our current needs. Ladies and gentlemen, the time has come for a reawakening of the land-grant university in the state of Michigan. And this reawakening must not be a mere theme, a slogan for a fundraising effort, or a helpful term that fits into speeches for all occasions. It must be a visible, tangible, and accountable attitude that pervades the entire state.
Michigan State University must have a renewed sense of what it is and where it is. I am concerned that in recent years we have occupied ourselves with who we are not, where we are not. We have become preoccupied with limitations rather than with opportunities. There must be a reawakened zest, a renewed vitality, an unfurling of self-confidence which marks this university as the revolutionary one I earlier mentioned. In these remarks tonight, I hope to suggest my own perspective of who and where we are. In my opinion, a State of the University address, if it is to be at all helpful, must be more roadmap than catalog. It should be more than an oral annual report offering one-line facts or pointing to numbers and symbols on a series of graphs and charts. To be sure, I use those facts, those charts and those graphs to assist in my advocacy of Michigan State University throughout our state. But in my first address of this nature, it is important to me that I share with you my sense of direction, of traditional commitment, of opportunities, and yes, even of our responsibilities. It would appear presumptuous, I imagine, if I presented you tonight with a full agenda for the remainder of the century, after being on campus for a little more than just 6 months. But the time has come, ladies and gentlemen, for some things to be said. And while there may be some risk in saying them now, there is more risk, in my opinion, in deferring them. Bertrand Russell said, what people really want is not knowledge, but certainty. And that demand for certainty over knowledge is a problem American institutions face today, at least in my opinion. Higher education is not immune to the problem. Michigan State University and the state of Michigan are not immune to it. Of course, we know that there can be no certainty without knowledge, but that does not halt the demand that we provide instant answers, ready-made solutions, and immediate responses to problems. If we are the relevant university we claim to be, then we must stand ready to react. I am afraid, however, that at times we have been asked to react when we should have been asked to lead. We have been asked to be relevant today when it is tomorrow we should be thinking of. There's a loss of tolerance for ambiguity in such a world, and the educational process is a victim of such a loss. We have seen programs and curricula formulated to react to pressing needs, only to find the monetary pressure or the momentary pressure was merely a symptom of something much larger. Perhaps worse, we have seen some programs and curricula termed not relevant for today and eliminated, only to find that some things are, after all, always relevant. In talks to various groups recently, I have referred to a column by Coleman McCarthy at the Washington Post. In an article harshly critical of Secretary of Education William Bennett, McCarthy charged that the Secretary, and I quote, has an agenda, not a vision. It is disconcerting that this agenda, not vision approach has taken hold throughout the entire land. It is an approach that demonstrates, as someone said, the arrogance of the now. A science fiction writer has called it temporal provincialism. And this attitude calls us to train rather than to be educated. It too frequently emphasizes the management of today over the leadership of tomorrow. I firmly believe that Abraham Flexner was right when he said, a university is not outside, but inside the general social fabric of a given era. But we must also pay heed to Jane Bryce's view that a university should reflect the spirit of the times without yielding it. Michigan State must always reflect our society's future and not merely react to the pressures and limitations of today. In a time when a five-year university presidency is labeled an era, and when research shows attention spans shrinking because of visual and informational overload, We must focus constantly on our obligation to serve long-term interests. I'm not certain if a National Hockey League player has ever been quoted in a State of University address, but I think a quote from Wayne Gretzky, the greatest single scorer, season scorer of all time, is now appropriate. When asked why he was able to break so many scoring records, Gretzky responded, "I skate to where the puck is going to be, not to where it's been." As I talk with our governor, legislators, and corporate leaders, I try to emphasize the fact that support for Michigan State must follow a formal recognition of exactly who we are. The time has come to define exactly who we are in relation to others nationally and in the state of Michigan. We are America's pioneering and premier land-grant university, and we are a member of the American Association of American Universities. Only 17 other institutions in this nation can make that claim. I think it's legitimate to conclude that Michigan State and the others constitute a peer group. Comparisons within this group provide us, I believe, with accurate and appropriate information. We are in that group of 18 because of our traditions, because of our achievements, our research, and especially the quality of our faculty, as represented by the honorees here with us tonight. We are not in that group because of our level of financial support. Indeed, if state appropriations was a criterion, we'd be in immediate danger of losing our membership. Let me be more explicit with you. We determined that our request to the state this year would seek funding that would place us in the middle of that group of 18. And let me say now for the record that Michigan State University should appropriately be at or near the top of that list. We would need this year an $80 million increase in our appropriation from the state if that realistic needs assessment were to be honored. It's no secret that we will not receive $80 million in any single year. We won't be receiving half of that. In any given year, we won't even likely receive a quarter of it. But Governor Blanchard is absolutely correct when he points proudly to the nation's leading support for education of Michigan. I know of no other governor in this entire nation who has taken as many risks to support education when what greater political gain might have been made elsewhere. His courageous stewardship of our mission has my deep personal admiration. Yet despite his best efforts in recent years, the historical fact remains. Michigan State has not been funded in a way which unlocks our potential to be a catalyst for our state and for our nation. Michigan will never fully become the comeback state until Michigan State University becomes the comeback university. And in some areas, I say frankly, we must catch up before we can even start to come back. I promise no charts or analyses to you, but there's one financial trend that is important to point out here. During the past decade, relative support of Michigan State University within the public higher education system of this state has not changed an iota. For example, in 1974-75, we received 23% of the higher education appropriation. In 1979-80, we received 23.2%. In 1985-86, we are receiving 23.1%. No matter what the political or economic climate, no matter who was in the legislature, in the executive office, our portion of the appropriations has not increased at all. And holding even, I need to tell you, is just holding on. Members of the Michigan State community, there cannot be much more delay, in my opinion, in recognizing that Michigan State University must be better funded by the state for the state. It is time to formally call for a partnership between Michigan State University and our sister university, the University of Michigan. We must be looked to as necessary leading partners to spur the state's growth, development, and the quality of its life. If our two universities are distinguished world-class universities, then within our state, we must be distinguished from other programs in very formal ways, in very creative ways. I have met frequently in the recent past with President Shapiro, and members of my executive staff have visited with their counterparts in Ann Arbor. Our faculties, as you know, communicate regularly. The academic rivalry simply does not exist in any negative way. But I would like to publicly state that if there are those who have used the perceived rivalry to their own advantage between our institutions, they will find it very difficult to do so in the future. No, I don't want to become another University of Michigan. Michigan cannot become another Michigan State. But let there be no doubt that what we have in common provides the state with an opportunity that very, very few other states enjoy. If there is doubt here about an equal partnership, I refer you once again to the words of President Cliff Wharton, who in 1977 urged the Michigan State faculty, and I quote him, to cast off the Avis mentality once and for all. He said, and I agree with him totally, that our faculty is second to none, not just in the state of Michigan, but in the United States. In so many quantifiable ways, the Michigan State University faculty is without peer. A faculty member with doubt is ultimately a faculty member who is doubted. Eleanor Roosevelt used to say, nobody can make you feel inferior without your own consent. In East Lansing, one does not need to look over his or her shoulder. You can see a world-class university by looking straight ahead. I will risk the criticism of those who disagree with me with what I'm about to say, because I know there are those who think differently than I do. I think faculty members of Michigan State have an obligation to be advocates as well as critics, to be proud as well as to be skeptical, to be partners as well as to be adversaries. President Wharton also said, I urge you to be more vigorous in speaking out in defense of the university, in defense of the academic enterprise, in defense of the quality of Michigan State University. Remember that every time a criticism unjustly leveled at any part of the university goes unanswered, sooner or later that becomes a fact, at least in the minds and the perceptions and the images of our various public. Well, I think that this is true in 1986, as it was when Cliff Wharton made those comments. When I think of my role in relationship to the faculty, I think of Winston Churchill's words. The nation had the lion's heart, he said. I had the luck to give the roar. Well, to every group I visit, be it a Rotary Club or a group of legislators, I base my advocacy for Michigan State on the faculty at our university. You are the enduring quality that is here. The unwritten success story in Michigan is a story about those minds that have not left the state during hard times. We have all read the brain drain story, and we all know of colleagues who have left. But the fact remains that men and women who can and will make a difference made a commitment to stay on the banks of the Red Cedar when they could have gone elsewhere, to places that beckoned with open pocketbooks, unlimited laboratory space, and promises of security. There is a loyalty here that has not received the attention I believe it deserves. And tonight I openly pay tribute to a world-class faculty committed to our university much more than anyone has ever recognized. Do you realize that I have had people from throughout the nation, indeed from throughout the entire world, pay tribute to our faculty? And they thank me as if I have something to do with your years of service here. From here on, I do have something to do with your service, And I pledge my consistent advocacy for all of you. And yes, I make a commitment to you that I will do all that I can to ensure that the debt we all owe you is repaid in more substantial ways than is currently the case. The relative ranking of faculty salaries at Michigan State must be improved significantly and very soon. There is a most significant change, I believe, that is demanded out of us. The role of the faculty, of course, is very much on my mind these days as we embark on our search for a new provost of this university. There is no more crucial task before us than the selection of the right man or woman to succeed Provost Lee Winder. The person who serves as the next provost will be selected after a search and selection process no less comprehensive than the presidential search. Not only must the person selected show the promise to be a future president of Michigan State, but that person must also have the education and the temperament to serve from the moment of appointment as the chief advocate of the academy. I have been asked what I look for in a provost, and this is an appropriate opportunity to share a few of my views on that subject. I want a provost who will be a partner in every sense of the word. I want a good manager, to be sure, but I want an academic leader above all else. I want someone who can articulate the role and the mission of Michigan State to vast and diverse audiences. We have heard that the next provost here must be someone who can manage change. Well, I would emphasize that I want a provost who can anticipate and create change as well. The next provost, I assure you, will be a woman or a man committed totally to the ideals of academic freedom. This provost must be at ease with Harvard President Derek Bok's observation that academic freedom is not merely a reflection of a society's commitment to free speech. It is a safeguard essential to the aims of the university and the welfare of those who work within it. At Michigan State, the search for truth must be a journey unimpeded by those from the right or from the left, and who fear ideas, who fear challenges, who fear being disproved. Finally, I want a provost who prefers dialogues to monologues. We must have academic leaders who thrive on participation in idea sharing, in governance sharing, in goal sharing. I want a bridge builder as the next provost, ladies and gentlemen, if you will. Before you conclude that I just announced that an engineer will be the next provost, since bridge building is a criterion, I want to emphasize that we are in no way limiting this search. We are not restricting the search by geography, by academic discipline, by gender, by age, by prior relationships with the president, or by anything else. Let it be known that the search will reflect not only Michigan State's written commitment to affirmative action and equal opportunity, it will also reflect the spirit of that commitment as well. As the academic vice president of Michigan State, our next provost will be asked to look to curricula and opportunities that provide lifelong opportunity. For example, the provost must believe, as I do, that an undergraduate education must never be forced to adapt itself to those temporary and temporal pressures I discussed earlier. Undergraduate education must prepare students not for their much-discussed first job, but for their last job as well. I add, too, that this lifelong commitment calls upon us to look openly and creatively to learning experiences that are non-traditional. A land-grant university must never limit its view of who its students are. We offer opportunity as no other university does, at least in my opinion. We are committed to access as well. But I would remind you that access without quality denies opportunity. If Michigan State is to select the best person available to be our next provost, the search process must be thorough and it must be relatively swift, adhering to a firm timetable, if you will. I know from personal experience that confidentiality is a necessary component of such a national search. The process must be open, clearly, procedures must be open. Progress must be reported regularly to the media. But if we are to avoid politicization of the search, and if we are to seek the best people in this nation, then we must be able to confidently tell candidates that confidentiality is indeed assured. Now, you might have discerned over the past half year that if the provost at Michigan State takes the place of the president when the president is off the campus, then this will be a very busy man or woman indeed. The external commitments of the presidency are especially critical at this point in the history of Michigan State. Just as this university has a statewide commitment to access, so does its president. In the very near future, I will be sharing with the Board of Trustees the status of planning for one of the efforts which makes my visibility off campus so important, the largest private fundraising campaign in the history of our institution. I have promised them and I promise you that we will not embark on this campaign until we are prepared totally for success. Oh, you know, while we might not be announcing campaign goals for a year or more, the ultimate success of the campaign depends on the work that we do now. The Capital Campaign team includes all members of the academic community because the needs we will be addressing will be your needs. The excellence we will be rebuilding upon is your excellence. The Capital Campaign, no matter how extensive or successful, should not be looked to as a panacea or an answer to our funding problems. The core needs of the university must be addressed by the public component of our funding sources. Neither should a capital campaign at Michigan State be looked to as a missing link in the state's economic development effort. I'd like to conclude my first State of the University address by mentioning two much-discussed areas of higher education that are seldom mentioned in the same breath or written about in the same report: economic development and students. Now, there's been a tendency to consider economic development only in terms of Neogen, MBI, and the relationship to the Michigan Technological Council. I suspect that perhaps I've played a role in reinforcing this too limited view of economic development in my own public comments, since I have spent much of my time talking about technological partnerships. Indeed, the scientific and technological genius that exists on this campus is personally very exciting to me and to those who plan for Michigan's future. However, we must never forget the greatest long-term economic development resource we have on this campus: our students. I talked earlier about the arrogance of the now, about how we are provincial in our approaches to time. We will be leaving future generations with many problems, ladies and gentlemen. We must choose to not be so self-assured that our generation will address all problems successfully. The energy source used to solve problems in the generation, in this generation, and all the generations that follow, come, is, of course, brain power. And this is a power source we must energize as never before. Economic development will be shallow, very shallow, if we don't consider the fact that human development precedes all technological development. We are preparing a generation that will live well into the next century. And I call upon us to make sure that we are educating them as well as training them for their new century. That education is cultural, it's social, it's visceral, as well as technological and scientific. We must prepare people to be good citizens, to be compassionate friends, to be human, as well as technological communicators. We must prepare students who will see the nuances as well as the bottom line. I urge you to join with me in encouraging students to take some risks while they are here. Risk-taking, for instance, that English Lit course. Risk attending a Wharton Center ballet. Risk crossing cultural and ideological barriers. And even risk not having free job offers at graduation. Now, I have a sense that students are missing something because of their reluctance to take risks. They are missing the excitement of the debate, of the challenging of ideas, of learning, if you will, to tolerate ambiguity. Now, this might sound surprising, coming from a man who's been quoted as saying being liked is very important to him. But I'll be taking risks in decision-making in the coming months that will guarantee that some people will not like my decision. They might even say that they don't like me. But think what I'd be missing if I didn't allow myself to become involved with the people at Michigan State, if I didn't become involved in the dialogue with the great minds gathered here, if I decided that being a spectator was far safer. Now, Adlai Stevenson paid a visit to my hometown of Detroit during the 1962 election, and he said, "My definition of a free society is a society where it's safe to be unpopular." The same holds true for a free university. Undergraduates as well as faculty must risk involvement in causes, experiences, and relationships that might be unpopular at the moment. We have done a very good job in convincing students that their Michigan State University education is worth very much. I want them to realize the value of their education as well. Join me, if you will, as I spread the word about the value of a Michigan State experience. Let us stress value as well as worth when we discuss the capital campaign, the search for a new provost or dean, or a partnership with our colleagues in Ann Arbor and throughout the higher education community. Ladies and gentlemen of the Michigan State University community, you are valuable, very valuable. But I must tell you are also valued. Thank you very much.